This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 26th of March on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up over the next hour, we take a tour of Le Corbusier's only construction in the Americas, a stunning house outside Buenos Aires in Argentina.
We're now in what we call the heart of the house, the terrace, central to Le Corbusier's work. In the 20s, he published his 5 points for new architecture. 5 points that, in his opinion, would be a benchmark for modern design in the years and decades to come.
We speak to design critic Alice Rawsthorne about her brilliant new book on the reality of the design industry, Hello World. And we drop in on an exhibition that tells us our homes are too noisy.
I think there's a big gear shift going on that is happening amongst the architects, the home builders, that we will be designing homes that can support and comfort our living experience rather than take away from that to support our oral health.
Elsewhere, we take a tour of the new Design Awards exhibition at the London Design Museum. We talk Niemeyer's legacy of school building in Brazil, and we turn our attention to new residential housing in Vienna too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's show in Argentina. Charles Edouard Jeanneret, better known as Le Corbusier, was a Swiss-born designer and urbanist who transformed modernist architecture from the 1920s in his adopted home of France. This spread around the world. He also inspired many other modernist icons, including Brazil's Oscar Niemeyer. More on him later in the show. Less publicised, however, is the Casa Curuche, the only house he designed in the Americas, located in Argentina. Monocle's Buenos Aires correspondent Ed Stocker travelled to the city of La Plata, Buenos Aires province, to find out more.
Leonardo is annoyed. People keep turning up at his house in La Plata wanting to look around. He lives in the Casa Curuchet. Wikipedia wrongly says the residence is open to the public. He's so fed up, he's turning people away. The scene is actually from Argentinian film El Hombre de Al Lado, The Man from Next Door. The fictional story of a designer who lives in a Le Corbusier-designed home. The house, however, is real. One of Latin America's best-kept secrets. Open to the public, Monocle gets a private tour with architect Julio Santana. So Julio, we're outside the house at the moment. We're looking at the facade. Can you just tell me a little bit about what we're looking at right now?
Bueno, la fachada de la Casa Curuchet está íntegramente construida.
The facade of the Casa Curuchet is made entirely from glass and concrete. The concrete forms a series of sun shields that were often used by Le Corbusier when working outside Europe's temperate to cold climate, as in places with tropical or subtropical climates such as Argentina or India. For the Casa Curuchet, located in front of a park, it's important as these shields frame the landscape and also temper the powerful sunshine in summer.
The house was built between 1948 and 1949 for Dr. Curuchet as his home and medical practice. He paid Le Corbusier $7,500 for the project.
Okay, Julio, so can you just tell me where we are? We've just come in through the front door. Can you just tell me what we're looking at now?
Bueno, hemos pasado el pórtico.
We've just passed the portico, also made of concrete, and we're now walking up a ramp, one of the main parts of the house and also a recurring theme in Le Corbusier's architecture. The ramp is known as an architectural walkway because it both unites and divides the different parts of the house.
Bueno, ahora seguimos recorriendo.
Okay, so now we're walking up the second part of the ramp, which leads to the workplace. This is where Dr. Curuchet's consultancy was located. He was a surgeon.
The first part of the house ends here, and we have to double back on ourselves to visit the second section, which starts with a high-ceilinged hallway, with walls constructed almost entirely of glass. Above, a kitchen and living room, and the all-important terrace.
Okay, so we just go up these steps then, and we'll see the last bit of the house.
Ahora estamos en lo que nosotros decimos que es el corazón de la casa. El corazón de la casa es la terraza.
We're now in what we call the heart of the house, the terrace, central to Le Corbusier's work. In the 20s, he published his 5 points for new architecture, 5 points that, in his opinion, would be a benchmark for modern design in the years and decades to come. But this house isn't from the 20s. It's from the 40s, 20 years after the publication of his 5 points. And yet this is the only house in the world built between dividing walls that incorporate all those points.
Our tour finishes with a visit to the two rather small bedrooms at the top of the house, one looking down onto the terrace below, where a crowd is starting to gather. The house has recently begun to function as a cultural centre. Tonight, a dance performance featuring video and sound from Proyecto in Bruto. Florencia Olivieri is the collective's director.
From a personal point of view, there's history of architecture in my family. So performing here struck a chord with me, and it was interesting to do. I also have a very architectural way of directing dance.
She says the house has something special.
The show plays with vision and distinct ways of seeing the human body. To have the chance to use a house where one of its key attributes is being able to see from lots of different angles is special. The house and the performance are complementary. The house allows this idea of seeing the body from different angles.
No one knows why Le Corbusier decided to build a house some 15,000 kilometres away from his French studio. The mystery remains, a little-known slice of modernist history in a sleepy Argentinian plaza. For Monaco in La Plata, I'm Ed Stocker.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Ed. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be talking residential housing in Vienna and the legacy of Niemeyer's schools in Brazil. But before that, we're back in London. In the sea of design events, exhibitions and fairs, it's all too easy to lose sight of what, who and where the greats are in terms of contemporary design. Just as well, then, that the London Design Museum has announced its nominees for the Designs of the Year 2013. The awards, which are handed out next month, have come to be seen as the Oscars of the design world, and the scope and breadth of the dozens of nominated designs exhibited makes it a must for anyone with an interest in surveying the gargantuan range of topics that design touches in modern life. David Pleasant, our researcher, went along to the exhibition to meet the Design Museum's director, Dejan Sudrich, along with award nominee and lighting designer, Anthony Dickens.
Every year, the museum tries to get a snapshot of where design is going by looking at interesting new work from around the world. We have about 50 or 60 spotters, nominators around the world, and each of them is asked to nominate two or three things that they've seen that has caught their attention or their interest in seven categories, which go from architecture to fashion to product to digital to furniture, transport, and from that, Pete Collar, the curator, has staged this year a great exhibition which shows actually 99 of those nominated schemes. And to me, they are an extraordinary, rich look at so many different definitions of design. One of the things that's always asked every year is how can you possibly judge a wheelchair against a royal wedding dress, or Maurits van der Meijer's digital candle against something like Kohler Light, which is one of this year's nominations, which is a remarkably powerful piece of work, which is about distributing rehydration kits to prevent childhood mortality in Africa by observing that the most efficient distribution system in that part of the world is the Coke bottling plant, which will have a system of deliveries in ever smaller quantities right down to the field. and the kits have been designed to fit in the interstices between the bottles and the case. You can't compare the two, and yet I think really the point of the award is to get people to ask the question, can you compare them? To really say that there's no one definition of design. Design can be about answering questions, but it's also about asking them.
Which leads me to, if you could kind of narrow it down, what, with regards to this award, what makes a good design? And you could encompass all those different types of design and objects and products. What's, in one sentence, what would you say to those candidates, those nominees?
There is no such thing as good design. That's a kind of idea that it's something like cod liver oil, which you take a spoonful of and you grimace as it goes down. To me, design has many definitions, but actually to have side by side work which is about social good, with work which is exquisitely beautiful, with work which is about ingenuity and technological change, is fascinating. So the point really is to explore the ranges rather than to say this is it. But I do hope that the overall category winners in the design of the year are something that we can look back on in 5 or 10 years' time to say this reflects something about this particular moment.
My name is Anthony Dickens and we're in the Design Museum in London.
And what's in front of us?
It's a light called Tekkyo, which is, Tekkyo means adaptation in Japanese, and it's a light inspired by Japanese chochin making.
A chochin is something that we're probably quite familiar with in the West. It's something we see a lot. Just about every house probably has something like it. Can you describe what that is?
It was made, I suppose, internationally famous by Isamao Noguchi, and he simplified chochin and stripped it of its colour. It's basically a paper lampshade with an internal bamboo frame, and you can make an infinite amount of shapes and designs out of them. Usually they're always one section, and they were traditionally used for denoting restaurants, and it's almost like a shop sign, and they have the Japanese lettering out on the outside. He stripped it of any colour and made it as simple and pure as possible, and the light that he made was called the Akari series, and what you see today are basically adaptations of that, very simplified mass-produced versions of his, which are beautifully made, handcrafted in Gifu in Japan.
There's a big difference because we're familiar with those almost kind of disposable paper lanterns that you can get very cheaply, which resemble what we're talking about, but what you studied and were inspired by is something very particular, and it's kind of a craft that is manufactured in a specific place in Japan that has a tradition of making that.
Yeah, Gifu became the centre of lamp making because of the forests around it, so they used that to make the bamboo and also to make the paper. I suppose it's kind of an interesting thing. I mean, Noguchi was a modernist, and in modernism they talk about the democratization of design. So you could argue, I think, fairly strongly that a lot of the early 20th century modernists failed in that remit because the stuff that they produced was very, very expensive. You know, Noguchi's original, the Akari lamps are still pretty expensive, but you know, they are now the imitations, I suppose. You get them for £3.50 in your local shop. But I suppose what I like of what I've been trying to do with Tekkyo is, in a way, to look at that democratization again. The light is an adaptation of a Japanese chochin, but the light itself is adaptable. It's a modular system, so each section can be bent from straight to 90 degrees. You then attach one section after another, you daisy chain them, so you can then create this infinite amount of shapes. So the thing that interests me as a designer, I'm trying to design better relationships between people and things. And this, you know, the light is now that I've made is almost a servant to the people. It can bend to your will, as I suppose.
And in fact, it's probably the most striking of the nominations that's displayed here, because it's, I don't know how many meters we're talking about. It probably stretches out over about, I don't know, 5-6 meters of the display space, and it's literally a kind of lit up snake almost that's snaking in and out of the kind of ceiling space, and then there's a circle, and then there's various kind of adaptations of the lamp on a pillar in the centre of the gallery. So it's truly adaptable. Is that what you intended?
What excites me the most, the reason why I've spent so much time and investment in getting it to where it is that I wanted to create something where other people could show their creativity. What excites me is that one day I might see installations that other people have put together, and I just I wouldn't have thought of doing it in that way. What you've got, you know, you've got wall fittings so that the light can go into a wall and make it look like it's kind of sewing itself like a worm, kind of eating into the wall and coming out the other side. Or you can have it simply hanging as a pendant. And there are other fittings that we're looking at introducing later on, but at the moment we're trying to keep it as simple as possible.
That was designer Anthony Dickens talking to our researcher David Pleasant at the London Design Museum there. You're listening to Section D. Up next, we'll be off to Vienna to talk new residential housing.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Home with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in, that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. We're all bombarded constantly with statistics of rampant urban growth. And it's not just an issue for the fast-growing urban centres of Africa and Asia. In Europe too, high on every government's agenda is how to deal with the constant influx of population to urban areas, and more importantly, where to house them. In the Austrian capital of Vienna, authorities have been running a biannual festival presenting new residential housing designs and techniques by way of engaging the city's architecture community in solutions to the ongoing challenges of urban growth. Alexei Korolyov went along for Monocle.
It is quite a throng at the third Wiener Wohnbaufestwochen, or Vienna's Residential Housing Festival. The vibrant and varied programme of events, which includes exhibitions, discussions and workshops, often goes well into the late hours, but the crowds are not dying down even then. The reason for such interest is simple, says a principal organiser of the festival, Johannes Luther. The city is growing.
And this time, the more or less overall topic of the housing festival is that Vienna is a growing city, so we are expecting to have again 2 million inhabitants in approximately 20 years, and Vienna housing policy has to react on that.
That would be 300,000 more Viennese than today. Luther, the managing director of Austria's leading urban development think tank, Europa Forum Wien, says architects, officials and residents need to talk about the challenges facing Vienna.
With the housing festival, we try to use different formats to a little bit stimulate the dialogue between the housing community, the municipal administration and housing policy, experts and users.
It is not an easy discussion. There are profound social implications to the design of a city.
One of our main challenges, our main ideas actually in housing, is that we want to achieve a social mix.
Wolfgang Förster is head of the Department for Housing Research at the City of Vienna. He says the mixing strategy has been working well in the city, where there is a long-standing tradition of different ethnic and social groups living side by side.
The mix that we try to achieve is actually by mixing different types of tenure within the same housing estate. This works actually quite well, because residents in Vienna are used to some sort of social mix. So it's not as segmentized or separated as probably many other European cities.
Casual visitors to the festival can take a guided tour of new development sites in Vienna. The most prominent exhibit is the Seestadt Aspern, a completely new district in a brownfield area which is scheduled for completion in 2030. Other displays include the development around Vienna's new main railway station and near the former Northern Railway Station. But in particular, the festival emphasizes the Wohngemeinschaften, or community housing, in which homes are developed and sometimes designed by groups of people themselves, for themselves. Robert Thiemel describes himself as a leading advocate of community housing projects in Vienna. He says they can breathe new life into the city's housing sector.
Housing is a sector which is not very innovative, and community housing projects are one way to develop this sector, to bring innovation in the housing sector in Vienna.
Thiemel says one of the advantages of this type of accommodation is that each project is unique.
They develop specific projects. They do not develop what is common on the market, what sells good, but they develop what they want.
Such projects were particularly popular in the 1980s, but then there followed a gap of some 20 years in which nothing of the sort was built. Uta Fragner says financing was a problem.
The gap is explained by the fact that objects and plots of land were unincorporated and were not financed.
Fragner co-founded one of Vienna's biggest community buildings, the Sargfabrik, which heralded the return of community housing when it was built in the year 2000.
Only recently, after the appearance of these newly built areas in Hamburg, Freiburg and Berlin, did the politicians discover that social activity could be effective for the development of a city, which otherwise risks turning into a network of ghettos.
Fragner says the main thing about community housing is that it actually is a community.
Social housing is very important in the sense that it makes people take responsibility for each other. That is, people can directly see what my needs are and how I can satisfy them.
That is something which Ingrid Farag, a founder of Austria's first women's housing project, also emphasizes.
That's the main point of it. It's having a common, as a community, where we invest in the sense of, yes, a little bit of money, but also our energy, caring sort of for each other. You know about the others, you know each other. We have regular meetings.
The Frauenwohnprojekt Calypso was completed in 2009.
There was a group of women who were interested in a women's housing project in 2002, I think, already. And we started this one in 2003. And we didn't find the space here until 2007, so it was a long way to go. And finally, we moved in 2009.
Farag, who has also overseen the creation of two similar houses, says the projects are not restricted to women only.
Whether women move in alone with a male partner, a female partner, with families, whatever, is their business, their private business.
It's hard to say now where exactly in Europe such projects originated. What is certain is that it wasn't in Austria. Festival organizer Johannes Luther says his country continues to learn from others.
The focus of the discussion is then how can Vienna benefit from those experiences, how can we develop, and what can be the perspectives for housing policy in Vienna of the future.
With many cities like London or Paris struggling with social problems and housing estates built in the 70s and 80s, perhaps this growing community-led approach to new projects can bring a brighter future. For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Section D. Still to come, we'll be talking to design critic Alice Rawsthorne about her new book, Hello World. And we'll hear from the head of Rio's World Heritage Institute too. But first, we're turning the volume down. The world's first quiet house was unveiled at the Ideal Home Show at London's Earls Court last week. The house, which was developed by Quiet Mark, a charitable foundation in the UK combating excessive and unnecessary noise, is designed with several elements to make it not only quiet, but to improve the quality of life for those who live there. Everything's got too damn noisy, is their driving belief. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, dropped in and spoke with Poppy Elliott, managing director of Quiet Mark. But before they began, they paused for a second to listen to the Quiet Heroes, a band that plays with silent instruments, including silent drums and silent pianos. Who better to kick off the launch of the Quiet House?
We are in the quietest room of the house, which was designed with several layers of insulation, isolation, acoustic boarding, insulated windows. Here we have a study with quiet computer, a fan that's been awarded for sound quality. It's very, very soft. And it goes on and on and on. So basically each room in the house has been designed to be as quiet and peaceful, but still have very high performance machines.
Yeah. How important do you think is quietness in general?
Oh, it's gold. When you're quiet, you can hear, you know, the still small voice of wisdom and calm that can download the genius to help our lives work well and best. And I think what's happening with this layers and layers of sound and noise, when you walk out into the urban environment, you're bombarded, and that takes away from that connection. It can affect our health very badly because there's stress levels, because sound actually affects your health and your emotions. So I think that it's paramount that this is started now before we all explode from too much noise generally.
And which kind of noises do people complain the most? And for example, what is the solution for that? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of solutions here at the Quiet House.
It's so personal. You know, some people are driven nuts by a shower pump. Other people are working with a computer every day, and other people who work in a car want a car that's a hybrid because they just know that there's a better way to journey with hybrid technology. So it depends really what's so personal, whether it's a washing machine or an instrument. Like we've got the most amazing Yamaha instruments here, where you can just play on the drums and piano, but your neighbours can't hear. So it's really great for neighbourhood noise too, helping your neighbours, loving your neighbours. Yeah.
Do you think in the future we're going to have more quiet houses?
Definitely. I think there's a big gear shift going on that is happening amongst the architects, the home builders, government, that we will be designing homes that can support and comfort our living experience rather than take away from that, to support our oral health.
It's very interesting that there's someone worried about noise pollution, because, I mean, especially when you live in a big city like London, it can be quite traumatizing sometimes, don't you think?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. And also because you can't see it with your eyes, it's difficult to articulate it. You know you're stressed and irritated, but you know it's just an accumulation of stuff you can't put your finger on. And you think maybe it's always just the amount of emails or something, but actually the noise and the sound of that impacting upon you. We're very sensitive creatures, some more sensitive than others, but generally we only can take so much before it affects our physical health.
And if I can ask like a personal question, even in your house, do you worry about those things? Do you have some tips to make it quieter?
Definitely. I mean, my life's been transformed on this journey of starting this this company with the Noise Abatement Society, which is basically, it's the not-for-profit trading arm, which all the profits go back into the charity. So what we're doing is helping the environment, just to get that clear, because this is not just about making money on products. This is about helping our health and abating excessive noise in our lives. So since I've been on this journey, I have literally made over my where I live at home, because we're always getting all these products in. And once you've tried a quiet one, you're like, why on earth would I go back to a noisy one when it performs so well?
That was Poppy Elliott, managing director of Quiet Mark, talking to our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be talking Oscar Niemeyer and Rio's architectural heritage after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Oscar Niemeyer, one of the world's most celebrated architects, died last December, still practicing right up into the remarkable age of 104. His influence, however, is set to live on in Brazil and elsewhere. The architect, known as the father of Brazilian modernism, became as renowned for his socialist and ideological principles as for the sweeping concrete curves of his creations. In the state of Rio de Janeiro, Niemeyer was tasked with designing a standardized high school building. More than 500 were built, and although they vary greatly, they've proved to be a source of inspiration for architects and educators the world over. To find out more about Niemeyer's schools, and on the occasion of Venice Takeaway, the UK exhibition of the British Pavilion at last year's Architecture Biennale, Monocle's David Pleasant met David Chambers of Aberrant Architects, and Washington Fajardo, who works for Rio's Mayor's Office and is in charge of Rio's World Heritage Institute.
So this part of the exhibition was our contribution to the Venice Takeaway exhibition, where we travelled to Rio de Janeiro to study a prefabricated schools programme that was built in the 1980s and designed by Oscar Niemeyer, working with the education expert Darcy Ribeiro.
What was it that you found when you looked into these buildings? I mean, explain a bit about what the design approach of Niemeyer was.
The main aim for the project was to deliver a large amount of schools in a short amount of time. They actually ended up building 508 identical primary schools all over the city and state of Rio de Janeiro. The buildings, they consist of a main principal building which contains classrooms on the first and the second floor and a covered playground on the ground floor with a roof which can be used for either a covered playground or as homes for kids who live there during the week. Along with the principal building, there were a series of accessory buildings designed, which ranged from a library, which also doubled up as a flexible workspace, swimming pools, allotments, covered playgrounds. And each site, you know, you picked and choose which accessories went with the principal classroom block, depending on the size and requirements of the site.
In terms of the form and what the buildings look like, they're distinctively Niemeyer. There's that kind of concrete element. And can you describe a little bit about the form? Like what makes them distinctive?
The decision to use concrete was primarily because that was the material that the local contractors were most comfortable with using. But as you can see, there's a distinctive Niemeyer curves present in the window openings, which I think do give the buildings a very distinct graphic image and facade, and which gives it a very distinct civic presence. I mean, everyone walking around Rio de Janeiro and different towns and cities can instantly recognize that it is a SIAPE, that it is a school.
SIAPE is the name of the, yes, the school. And in terms of bringing back to you and your work here in Britain, why do you think this is an important project or an important example, case study to look at? What is it that you hope to achieve in terms of studying the work of Niemeyer?
I mean, there is a big debate happening right now surrounding the whole issue of standardization in design, especially with schools. The current coalition government have stipulated that all new schools built in the UK need to be from a standardized design. What we were quite interested in looking at the Niemeyer example in Rio is that in the UK, the idea of standardization is seen as somewhat as a dirty word, and it has a lot of negative connotations to do with reducing quality, reducing sizes, reducing, you know, producing uninspiring designs. Whereas the SIAPEs in Rio, it seemed to be more about coming up with a great piece of bespoke architecture and then mass producing it on a big level so that you can deliver high quality educational architecture to as many school children as possible. And we thought that's a very interesting idea and hugely relevant for the current conversation in the UK.
Do you think realistically we can go back to that kind of approach in the UK or in Europe? It feels like we've gone through so many cycles. Is that moment past? Do you think we can go back to that phase?
Well, the standardized schools are happening right now, so that's what they're bringing back. And there's a contractor who's already delivered, I think, one or two examples of their standardized school concept already. So I think this is certainly something that we are returning to, whether we like it or not. And I guess the ambition for us looking at this project is maybe we can see standardization as actually something that can be seen as positive and not be so, you know, negative and reactionary against it.
And just in terms of the concept of design, and you mentioned the word bespoke, I think those kind of words are very kind of fashionable at the moment, but when you talk about standardization, that concept evaporates somewhat. So what would you tell the detractors of these kind of standardized, concrete, some people might say mass-produced schools? How could you sell them to people who are scared of that kind of approach to architecture?
I'm not saying that what we should do is implement the CIPs here in the UK, not at all. But I think what is interesting is that this was a project that was designed as a hugely ambitious school project that linked the architectural spaces to a full-time curriculum program. And I think if standardization is used in the right way, where it is about trying to make a little go further, as opposed to just reducing the costs and reducing the quality of the materials and reducing the overall ambition, then I think it does have an interesting role to play.
My name is Washington Fajardo, and I'm president of the Institute of Rio World Heritage, and I came to London to talk about the CIEPs and make a contribution to the local discussion about the standardization of schools and architecture.
And CIEP is an acronym, is it? For, yes. Could you explain?
Integrated Center for Public Education.
And tell us about the history of the CIEP. We've heard from David about the British interpretation within the exhibition, but what's the history? Tell us.
The CIEP's got a very interesting history. They was created in the first years of the beginning of the new democracy in the country of Brazil, specifically in the state of Rio de Janeiro. So the city and the state and the country, it was left in the dictatorship. And so there is a lot of discussion about the problems of the present, of the future. So education, it's a big issue at the time, and until now it's a very important issue. So the governor of the state of Rio, the Secretary of Education, Darcy Ribeiro, they got this idea about the possibility to create a standard school that could be possible to take care of the whole state. So they thought about a public policy that it was able to spread for the whole territory of the state of Rio de Janeiro. So they made this, they built it more than 500 schools. It's impressive.
We've seen that they're large buildings, that they're big, they're made out of concrete. What are the challenges for you to maintain them?
Well, it's interesting because the structural aspect is still in the very good shape until nowadays. In fact, the concrete, and we got a lot of expertise with concrete, structured concrete.
It's something that Brazilians specialize in.
Yes. We got problems talking about the quality of the interior of the classroom. At the time, they got the concern about the cross ventilation, and that goes wrong. There's some new elements to correct that, but still an issue now. But CIEPs, it was a very paradigmatic case and create a lot of new copies, a lot of new solutions, and in the whole country. So now it's possible to see other standard schools in São Paulo, in federal schools, in other parts of the country. CIEPs is still as a very important beginning for this process. And until now, in this moment, there is a discussion in Rio about the creation of new standard schools.
And CIEPs will be an important influencing factor to whatever happens next in Rio. There's always the memory and the presence of these important buildings. If there's a consciousness about these buildings with the Rio population, does they have a positive connotation that normal people on the street, not just architects or specialists, what do people or students think about these buildings?
When the CIEPs are in good condition, people love the Seps because it's possible to go inside and play football, and there's a community use of that venue. But in the peripheral cities, and there's a lot of Seps with troubles, and until some of them abandon. Well, it's interesting because it's the same SEP that you got into a rich neighborhood, you got into a peripheral neighborhood. So the idea and the concept of this, the same equality in different kinds of parts of the territory, it's a very good thing. So the common people understand this kind of value and make respect to that. But for sure, this kind of territory needs to be alive to become a good place to go to study.
That was Washington Fajardo, head of Rio's World Heritage Institute, talking to our researcher David Pleasant there. And for our final story on this week's show, we dialed up design critic and former director of the London Design Museum, Alice Rawsthorne. Rawsthorne has recently published a new book called Hello World. It successfully tackles the many issues at the heart of the design industry today. It's not about prettifying or furnishing or bigging up the many egos that are big enough already. No, it tackles the bigger questions at the heart of the industry, with a lot of very beautifully written, easy-to-read words. What is design, and what place does it have in our lives today? What are its benefits, and what are its failings?
The aim of the book is to really to explore the impact of design on our lives in the past, at the present, and in the future. I didn't write it for designers. I wrote it for the intelligent general reader who's interested in design, probably doesn't know an enormous amount about it, at least not in a formal way, and probably isn't willing to buy 7 or 8 books to find out about it, but might want to buy one.
And tell us a little bit about your approach to the subject. You say there it's not a book for designers, and design is a word that is sort of bandied about more now than ever in all sorts of contexts, which to people who aren't in the design industry, it might be a little bit baffling to actually understand exactly what design is.
Well, one of the huge challenges of writing the book was that I had to spend a lot of time wrestling with what design actually is, because as you rightly say, it's a very tricky, elusive, often confusing concept. And one of my motivations for writing the book was because I feel design has been misunderstood and misrepresented and marginalized over the years. I mean, typically it's confused with styling, when there's much, much more to design simply than how things look. It also tends to be seen as purely as a commercial tool that's practiced by professionals who've been especially trained to do so. When actually, if you look back throughout history, before the word design or the original word diseño was ever thought of, let alone heard, human beings have intuitively practiced design and have done so instinctively and subconsciously without knowing what they were doing, really whenever they've sought to change their surroundings. So what I've tried to do in the book is put the concept of design in its cultural context to show how our perceptions of it have changed over the centuries, and to look at what design means now.
Quite interestingly, in the book as well, you pinpoint examples where design promised a lot but failed to deliver. Is that as a way of sort of learning from our previous mistakes, or is it just to show that design isn't the be-all and end-all and the answer for everything?
Well, both. I mean, I'm personally passionate about design and think it has tremendous untapped potential to improve the quality of our lives in many, many different ways. And luckily for us, there's a new generation of dynamic designers who are, you know, putting that theory into practice and proving that it works. But it would be foolish to pretend that every design exercise is successful. And one chapter in the book, I mean, it follows a chapter on what is good design. The next chapter is entitled, So Why Is So Much Design So Bad? And the brutal truth is, of course, that the vast majority of design projects, they're not necessarily bad, but many of them are deeply mediocre. They're certainly not inspiring or original or imaginative or extraordinary intelligent. And I think it's interesting to look at why that's the case, because I don't think anyone ever sets out to design anything badly, but occasionally that happens.
I mean, one of the specific projects covered is the One Laptop Per Child by Yves Bihar, which promised so much and actually delivered a lot more than many sort of design projects do. It didn't provide a laptop for $100 to every child in Africa, which I think it set out to, but it did provide 1 million laptops for $187, is that right?
Exactly, which is no mean feat. And this was the very ambitious sort of design education stroke technology program that was initiated by Nicholas Negroponte from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab. And he roped in a group of designers, including Yves Bahar, who designed the hardware for the computer. And his aim was, Nicholas Negroponte felt that the single most useful project that he could invest his time and energy in would be to improve the learning potential, the educational potential of children in developing economies, the argument being that this would then empower them to be able to improve their own lot and their family's lot in life and therefore their wider communities and their countries. And, you know, obviously in principle that makes perfect sense. And he believed, being a technologist, that the single most useful tool he could give those kids was a laptop. And so the objective of the One Laptop Per Child project, which, you know, it was a wonderful project, still is, it's still going, because it was hugely ambitious, really launched with the best of intentions, and a lot of very, very talented people were involved. So the sort of design rationale for the project was to design down the cost of a laptop whilst producing a laptop that was absolutely fit for purpose for kids who needed educating, so access to information, the ability to connect with other kids and their teachers in the developing world, but would cost as little as possible so that the governments in those countries would be able to afford to buy them. And, you know, I would consider shipping 1 million laptops to kids who otherwise might never have seen a computer, let alone owned one of their own, is a really incredible achievement. But unfortunately, the initial rhetoric for the project was so overblown that, you know, many, many millions of laptops were expected to be shipped very quickly. That didn't happen. As you rightly say, they didn't manage to get the cost down to $100, but did get it down to about $187. And there have been various copycat or similar projects that have been launched. So One Laptop Per Child is a very interesting example of a design project that was launched with really the best of intentions, but did achieve a great deal, just rather less than it set out to do. So there are rather a lot of moral lessons to be learnt from the story.
But, I mean, it's interesting then, because it is about rhetoric more than anything, isn't it? And the rhetoric was ambitious and powerful and captured a lot of people's imagination, which is also another facet of good design, isn't it? It's about possibility.
Nicholas Negroponte's argument has always been that he was consciously sort of, he exaggerated the rhetoric in the early days because he felt if he hadn't captured people's imagination by talking about big numbers and bold claims, then he wouldn't have been able to raise so much investment for the project. But unfortunately, it also sort of doomed it to defeat on its own objective. But as you rightly say, one of design's great gifts is the ability to inspire and enthuse, to communicate messages very accurately to people, but in a particularly engaging and empowering way. So if you look at the new genre of social design projects, these are the social design groups who are really using design to crack fundamental social problems of our time, dysfunctional areas of the welfare state, like provision of care for the elderly, encouraging the long-term unemployed to come back into the workforce, integrated disaffected young people within their local communities. The sort of the skills that they identify as being most useful from designers include things like communication skills, the ability to problem solve, and the ability to think of lateral solutions. But it's really communication skills that are at the heart of it, both in communicating with people to find out what they need from new design exercises, and then to persuade them to adopt the solution.
That was Alice Rawsthorne, author of Hello World, talking to me there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be talking about the booming infrastructure scene at a new exhibition in London. We'll find out how maps are being made for the blind. And we'll drop in on a former colleague of Monocle and friend of the family, who's recently opened a stunning new stationery shop in London too. This show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. If you'd like to bend Alid's ear on any burning subject you feel we should be covering in Section D, drop him a line at awj@monocle.com. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out with tongue firmly in cheek in honour of this year's Design Museum Designs of the Year Awards, here's ABBA with The Winner Takes It All. Goodbye.